Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice radio show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal economic opportunity and justice for all without truth decay. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing both creative artists and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Hello and welcome to the Reasonable Voices News Talk Radio program. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. And my Reasonable Voice today is the writer and director of the documentary feature film Bella, Jeff Lieberman. Jeff Lieberman is an award-winning journalist, producer, filmmaker, and the founder of Re-Emerging Films. Bella, the Jeff Lieberman documentary feature, was one of the two winners of the Washington, D.C. Library of Congress Ken Burns Prize for Film. And Lieberman's Bella will open theatrically in New York on Friday, August 18th, 2023, at the Village East by Angelica, and in Los Angeles on Friday, August 25th, 2023, at the Lem Lee. Bravo, Jeff Lieberman, and welcome to the Reasonable Voices News Talk Radio program. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I really, really am looking forward to this. Jeff, you know, with your many professional accomplishments, and instead of taking time listening to me list them, I want to let you talk about them. So, for instance, in addition to Bella, you were also writer, director, and producer of The Amazing Nina Simone and Reemerging the Jews in Nigeria. Your award-winning film has been called the best of the three Nina Simone films by the New Yorker magazine, and the Nina Simone film We Should Be Watching by Blavity. So, tell us a bit about your 2015 feature documentary film, The Amazing Nina Simone.
Yes, I'm happy to talk about Nina. That was really a very joyous experience for me to make that film. I am a lifelong Nina Simone fan. I made that film basically because it took me a long time to truly understand Nina Simone, and I'm not even sure I'm 100% there or ever will be. But I wanted to add context to my own song listening experience and know when these songs were recorded and what the timing was like and what Nina's intentions were. And I was listening to a lot of her music sort of out of order on compilation CDs or streaming, and didn't quite get the whole story. And the more I read about her and her own biography and biographies that were written about her and watched pieces on her, I got a whole different understanding about who she was as an artist and an activist. And I thought other people could benefit from that too. And I thought Nina herself deserved to have her legacy preserved in a way that really honored her her artistry. Oftentimes I would hear people say they went to her concert and she was drunk or she was crazy, and I really sort of wanted to kind of understand what they were experiencing. And through the film, I think I laid out that it was likely neither of those two things, that she was just a brilliant, eccentric artist who also suffered from some mental health issues, but was really trying to tell truth to power and did it in very bold ways that people were not used to seeing. And I think people get a better understanding of her through that film, and that's always my goal with the documentary.
Wow. Well, that's excellent. Reemerging. I've heard some of the things that you have said about Nina Simone, but not as much. I have to see your documentary now. That's all there is to it.
Yes.
Reemerging, The Jews of Nigeria. Now, that received rave reviews from the New York Times, NPR, The Hollywood Reporter, The Village Voice, The New York's Amsterdam News, proclaiming the film as one of the must-see documentaries of 2013. So I'm certain everybody would love to hear about your Academy Award-qualifying documentary film, Reemerging, The Jews of Nigeria. The title alone, I guess, says it all, but it also intrigues me because, well, I guess I don't know so much about what this documentary is about. Please tell us.
Yeah, that was my very first independent documentary. The idea fell into my lap. I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and I got invited to a lecture at a synagogue that I sometimes attended, and it was given by an American rabbi who had gone to Uganda and Nigeria to meet people who were there who were practicing Judaism. At that time, largely unknown to the rest of the Jewish communities around the world. And I was really mesmerized by just a few photos that he showed in his slideshow and spoke about. And one image in particular stood out to me. There was a little hut in what looked like a forest or a jungle. And as you got closer, you could see a Star of David on the building.
Wow.
And just thought, wow, like here in the middle of the wilderness, as it looked to me at that time, was a Jewish community, and how fascinating. So I approached him afterwards and I asked him why he had no video of any of these experiences. And he said it was just largely him and a little disposable camera that was taking these images. I said, the next time you go, I'd love to join you. And he thought I was kind of joking or not serious. But he called me about 6 months, 9 months later and said, if you're actually serious about coming, I'm going back. Go get your vaccinations, go get your visa, get whatever you need together, and we'll go.
Wow.
And I didn't really know what to expect, but I went, and I had zero funding at that time, so I shot all of it myself and started editing it all myself when I came back, because I just kept applying for grants and kept trying to move it forward, and that's how I sort of became, you know, a filmmaker that shoots and directs and edits and writes.
Yes.
And independent work.
Yes. You know, when people ask me that question, how did you do, you know, able to wear all those hats? And I go, well, when you begin, you have no choice.
Right.
Yeah. Oh,
it
well.
It makes you better at what you do when you're aware of all the components that go in. It gives you an appreciation for the people who do it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, my question was to share some of your memories about that, but you certainly did, and that's fascinating. But after it got released, it went to what? It was in New York and Los Angeles and premiered at festivals all over, Toronto, Boston, Washington, Vancouver, London, Switzerland, Israel. Was this a surprise? Forgive me if that's a naive question. Was this a surprise that it was received this way, or did you expect it? You know, what did you think?
On the one hand, it was a surprise because, after all, it was just me and, you know, a camera and my own sort of limited skills. But on the other hand, like, the stories were so eye-opening and so heartwarming that it wasn't a surprise that people would gravitate towards the film. I knew, basically, within the first few days of being there, that I had a film on my hands. I went, you know, essentially as an experiment, but there was no doubt in my mind that after the first few days of filming some of the first few interviews, that, like, there was a very special story here, simply because the people I was documenting were so genuine and so sincere and so humble, and weren't really looking for any like acknowledgement or validation. They were just, you know, sharing their story, and they were happy to do so. And for those who are interested, it's the Igbo people of Nigeria, and it's a small section of them who sort of see very strong similarities between Judaism and their own Igbo traditional ways, and deny that there might be some sort of link, and have taken this and are basically practicing Judaism with very few resources in Nigeria, and just basically making things work, you know, and making sacrifices to lead a Jewish life, you know, because they don't have kosher meat, or they don't have prayer books, or they can't order things on Amazon. It's just like they create their own, and it's really, really beautiful to witness.
Wow, that is fantastic. So, well, first of all, that's a fascinating story about both films, and you, I would say, when I first started to listen to you and research you, it sounds like you are very interested in documenting women who have been forgotten or should be remembered, or their full story should be told. But I can't pigeonhole you in that, because there are a lot of other things you've done as well, and I'm sure you don't want to be pigeonholed. But what, for instance, you've done digital content for Coca-Cola and Showtime's Homeland and Entertainment Tonight and The Insider and Macy's, Wine Enthusiast Magazine, and, well, it's a long list. Like I said, we want to hear you talk, not me. But tell us something about that. And you've done some behind-the-scenes making of Hollywood's biggest films. What's that all about?
Yeah, so that was really how I got into documentary in the first place. Was one of my first jobs in the entertainment industry was working for a company that was producing all the behind-the-scenes making of the movie documentaries that one would, you know, back in the day get on a DVD or that plays on HBO, kind of, you know, behind the episode kind of material. And that was really a very fascinating experience for me, because I could really see that shooting a documentary is quite an affordable way to start a project, unlike, you know, a feature narrative where you need costumes and makeup and hair and sets and, you know, large crews to get going, and you're shooting it all at once in a very condensed 3 month or 1 month period. A documentary you could kind of space out over time and approach with a smaller crew. And it's, you know, for a young filmmaker, I was 28 when I first started my first film. Making a documentary was a much more affordable way to go, and I thought that could be a good entryway into establishing myself as a director. And the other work that you mentioned, as I formed my company, I began doing work for other companies as well to pay the bills, but also to be creative and exercise some different muscles. And so I produced a lot of online content for Coca-Cola and Wine Enthusiast Magazine. I did a lot of travel pieces and feature pieces and wine pairings and wine and food videos, which are a lot of fun to do.
Yes, yes. I'm enjoying this because it's the way of the artist. And if you can find art and creativity and grow in various different ways, you work more and you learn more. And then, of course, you ultimately produce more, which is, well, I guess that's a good question to ask. How did those experiences launch you onto the path you are currently traveling?
Yeah, I think it gave me a good, anytime you're behind the camera and you're lighting something or choosing angles or choosing movements, you're just becoming a better artist and you're becoming more familiar with your tools. And then the same goes with editing. Like, the more you edit with music and graphics and pacing and story, and it all just, it makes you stronger. And I was also a news producer for many years at CBS and CNN, and that really sharpens your skills too.
Yes.
And telling a story in 2.5 minutes is even harder.
Yes. Yes. You know, that was my next question about you and CBS and the New York Post. And so I'm glad you jumped right into that, because it's true. I did a lot of cutaways so that we were the news break, the local news break for national syndication. And I know what you're saying, you know, trying to get the news stuck in 2 minutes. That's an art. That's a talent. Especially when, yes, and especially when some of those stories are quite painful, you know, or tragic, and yet you still have to be your professional self, and you still have to do it within 2 minutes.
True. Yeah, I love that experience of being in a newsroom, you know, with two breaking deadlines.
Yes.
Every day. It's a whirlwind. It's a rush.
Yeah.
But it makes you smarter, faster, better, and it really gives you an appreciation for all the content that comes out every day. And, you know, documentary is a different beast, because you don't see the joys of your work so immediately. You really have to have a lot of patience to see the final outcome. But it's a different appreciation, and that is something really special, too.
Before we go to break, I want to know, what did you do with the Obama inauguration and the 10-year anniversary for 9/11?
Well, the 10-year anniversary for 9/11, I had a really fascinating experience, because the World Trade Center towers were not yet complete, but I got to go inside the building that was being built.
Oh, wow.
And I think I went up maybe 50, 60 stories in a building that had no windows and no walls.
Which
was daunting. So it was me in a hard hat with my camera and equipment, basically filming the progress of the building. And I also got to go down inside the lower levels and film there too. And it was really special to have that experience and be on that sacred ground, but
yes,
also sort of be a witness as to what was coming.
Yes, yes, what came after. How did you get that? That's fascinating.
That was a piece I did for the New York Post, and the Post was invited to come see the progress.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And the Obama inauguration?
Right, so that was a piece for CBS that I was doing from New York, but being fed material from the inauguration back to New York, and, you know, putting together a piece on all the events that were happening that day and piecing things together and updating the stories. And as more and more footage came in, trying to find different angles and pieces and trying to document that historic event.
So post-production as well, of course.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
You wear all the hats. You really do.
Writing.
All right, we're going to take a break. This is fascinating. And I promise everyone, including my guest, it's Onward and Upward with Bella and our writer-director Jeff Lieberman when we return. So stay with us, because the best is yet to come. We'll be right back. Hi, I'm Marcello Rolando. As promised, Rolando and Dresner Productions is creating a new musical to sow hope where there is uncertainty. It's about relationships and reconnecting. It's about, in every situation in life, making sense of it all, reconsidering all points of view. It's about reassembling our humanity and together making it all work out. Visit us on YouTube at Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. But first, here's the song, It Will All Work Out, by Larry Dresner.
Was nice and cozy with the sun around me. Then I felt a raindrop and the skies were suddenly all cloudy. Now here I'm standing in the rain, no umbrella, no overcoat, no money, sometimes forced to sing in a cappella. Before you lose your temper and your mind gets in a flurry, just tell yourself, never cry and never, never worry. It'll all work out. It can't rain forever. It'll all work out somehow for the better. If you just keep hanging on, there'll always be another chance to reach that brass ring, no matter what. starts to bellow. I don't know what to do now. Everything's gone crazy. I don't know where to go now, 'cause my dream has gotten dim and hazy. Sometimes you're dealt a bad hand, but you keep on playing. I know you're not a quitter. Listen now to what I'm saying. Chance to reach that brass ring. No matter what the weather, you can always sing and sing and sing and sing. It'll all work out. It can't rain forever. It'll all work out somehow for the better if you just keep hanging on.
For more information, listen to our Rolando and Dresner Productions podcast on YouTube at Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. Thank you. Welcome back to The Reasonable Voice's News Talk Radio program. Our guest today is director-writer Jeff Lieberman, who has been talking to us about his glorious filmmaking history. We love it. Everything, starting with One Camera in Nigeria and all the hats he's worn since then and everything we discussed in the first segment. But now we want to talk about the award-winning work by Jeff that is currently coming to us in New York and in Los Angeles, and that is Bella. I'll give you a few quotes. Here's a quote from Barbara Streisand. Bella was way ahead of her time, and the rest of the world had to catch up. And quoting filmmaker Ken Burns, thank you, speaking about Jeff's Bella, it is one of the most energetic and wonderful films. And last but not least, a quote from our guest today, Jeff Lieberman, in response to receiving the Library of Congress Ken Burns Prize for Film. Quoting, "Being recognized by Ken Burns is an incredible honor. I've long admired his work and count him among the artists who have shaped my filmmaking. He's as inspiring to me as Congresswoman Bella Abzug, whose trailblazing fights for social justice are a crucial and undertold part of our history. With this grant, we are one step closer to completing the film, ensuring Bella's vision for equality and democracy are not forsaken." Unquote. That's a tough one to follow up, Jeff. Excellent. Well, how was that when you heard the news? And one of the hats I didn't mention in this particular segment, you write your own grants, for heaven's sake. Apply for them in any case. How was that when you heard the news that you had won?
Oh, it was life-changing, really. I mean, it really changed the whole scope of this film. But, you know, being recognized by Ken Burns as an artist myself is really life-changing, too. And it was such a beautiful honor. And I was so grateful because this was a tough film to get attention for. Bella's not necessarily a household name, and we want her to be. We want people to know her legacy and her sacrifices. But we needed support, and writing grants is not an easy game. It's often like winning the lottery these days. And being recognized as a nominee for the Library of Congress Ken Burns Prize was a huge thrill. And then we won. Our film and another film took the top prize at a ceremony at the Library of Congress in October. And the grants that came with it was the thing that made us able to complete the film. A lot of people don't realize that a lot of the expenses with documentaries often come at the end because there's so many post-production costs that are pricey. And then if you're licensing material, archival material, like this film is very archival rich, it's very expensive. And so you can get to a certain place and then you're kind of stuck because you need money to get over those last few hills. And this prize and the sort of stamp of approval and the publicity that came with it really got us going again. And I'm so grateful to Mr. Burns and to the Library of Congress and the Better Angels Society who administer the award. So yeah, it was very exciting.
It must have been, really. And, you know, we do have some people who might be too young to remember Bella Abzug. Remember this, or let me tell you if you did not experience it. In 1970, the United States was ruled by men. And that's the world that Bella lived in. And in 1970, she entered Congress ready for a fight with her trademark hat and Bronx swagger. The first elected feminist upended the Washington patriarchy, battling for women's equality, civil rights, and LGBTQ protections. Despite Nixon and the FBI's attempts to silence her, Bella persisted, revolutionizing the blueprint for America. From 1971 to 1977, Bella Abzug served as a member of the House of Representatives. And here's what I remember about her. Her campaign slogan was, "This woman's place is in the House and the Senate." That's where the war began, with all the people who tried to stop her. Tell us more, Jeff, about this film and about Bella.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Congress was 97% male in Bella's first term. That's 435 House members, and 11 of those were women, including Bella. I mean, it's just an unbelievable statistic when you think about it today. And it's still not 50% equal either. It's still, women are in the vast minority. But for Bella, who saw that the system was, you know, designed and or being designed to shut out women and people who cared about social justice and peace, anti-war, cared about mothers and childcare and equality and civil rights, Congress was not a place that was really interested or willing to hear those arguments or use the institution to implement change that might better people's lives. And Bella and other people like Shirley Chisholm and Ron Dellums and Charlie Rangel all came into Congress right around that same time. Shirley Chisholm a few years before, but and Ron Dellums too, but Charlie Rangel and Bella were first elected in 70 and went to Congress in 71 and had an agenda to really represent what their constituents were feeling. And one of the largest things was an end to the Vietnam War, which they really pursued hard in Congress. And Bella was, you know, introduced a motion on the first day of Congress. She wasted no time. And she was battling a lot of very patriarchal practices. She was shut out of a lot of meetings, committees, and, you know, she really had to go headfirst into the building to try and implement change. You know, just courageousness, the boldness, I think is evident in the film, and I think is really inspiring to many people. I think it's sort of an example of a lot of challenges one might face in one's life, where institutions are built not to be disturbed. And Bella's an inspiring force to try and implement change, which I think a lot of people will recognize as inspiring.
I think that's such a great way to put it. Institutions are built not to be disturbed. Is that what you said?
Disturbed, yes.
That is great. I'm going to steal that one, Jeff. That is great. I want to mention something because I, of course, was alive then during this time. And what I remember, a specific thing that I know, I believe your film deals with, is Bella's battling for credit cards for women. So all of you females, 10 years old and above, I want you to listen to this, and I'm going to ask Jeff to add his comments. But I met a woman in theater. I was directing a show, and she wanted to be in the show, and they wanted her, but she was not the best actor, but she was a fabulous singer, and so I worked with her, etc. But she was in the midst of a divorce, and she could not get credit cards in her own name. Let me say that again. In the United States of America, in the 1970s, a woman who got a divorce, who had may have had shared credit cards with her husband, could not then get her credit cards in her own name. Jeff, please take it from there. I helped her get them, and I'm telling you, it was a lesson for me, because I got on the phone and chewed out an awful lot of people at credit card companies, including female employees. So, wow. Tell us what you did, which is far more, making this film. on that particular subject and anything else.
Right. So all women, regardless of their marital status, regardless of any type of employment, any type of status, was not able to get a credit card in their own name before Bella Abzug introduced this legislation in 74 that would permit women to receive a credit card in their own name. Prior to that, you'd have to have a husband's signature or a father's signature or some sort of male figure. I assume, like in your situation, a friend could do it. But women were not seen as credit worthy or a reliable lender, borrower. And I suppose that was just, you know, there was no real thinking beyond just this patriarchal, misogynistic system that didn't value women as equal. And Bella saw this as one of the first issues that she wanted to confront. Not the very first, but one of the really central issues, as she saw that she could really be a force for bettering the lives of women. And it's interesting because she's known as such a feminist and founding mother of the feminist second wave feminist movement. But as the film shows, she didn't really come to that right away. Mm. It was on her mind, of course, and she always valued the idea of women being equal. And she herself became a lawyer in the 1940s and was very independent and married a man who was very supportive of her working and taking on some really ambitious legal cases. But in the 70s, she really went to Congress to A, to end the war in Vietnam, and B, see that Richard Nixon was impeached for a variety of number of crimes that she saw. But slowly, she saw her power in bettering the lives of women, and women were really advocating for her to make changes like this. And that is really one of the biggest elements of her legacy, is the equal credit law, which really helped balance the scales for women in the professional and banking fields. You know, it didn't do much for equal pay or the employment world, but it did at least give women a chance to have some independence financially.
Mm, yes. How far, you know, she ran into so much resistance, as we both know, in saying that the Washington establishment just resisted change, still does, but at least there's some flexibility now, thanks to women like her. But how far did they go back then, this anti-Bella attempts to restrain her?
I mean, I think it started on day, actually, you know what, before she even got there were news articles kind of warning that she was coming. I was sort of surprised as I was going through the newspaper archive that, you know, she was elected in November of 70 and didn't, you know, show up to be sworn in until January 71. And during that entire period, there was these articles that were setting up the battle. The press was like equally excited for this idea that Bella was going to take on the system, and how dare she, and how awful was she going to be, and would she wear her hat on the floor, and would she talk in a way that was undignified. All these ideas that were sort of cemented in the minds of the politicians on the Hill because they were seeing these articles. So already there was an imbalance from the very beginning. And they weren't entirely untrue. Bella was coming in there to challenge the system, and she did. But she also was very strategic, as the film shows, and created a lot of alliances and wasn't scared to reach across the aisle. People like Carl Albert, the speaker, admired her in many ways. It took some time. The next speaker, Tip O'Neill, made her a whip. I mean, they really saw her as a very powerful figure. And by 76, she was voted the third most influential figure in Washington.
Yes.
You know, which is, that's a long list of people to get that status.
Did she ever think about running for senator or mayor of New York?
Oh, she sure did.
yes, I know. Tell us.
She served 3 terms of Congress, narrowly being redistricted and having a, you know, all-out brawl to get her seat back on the streets of New York. But she served for 6 years in Congress and then saw her next goal, her next ambition was to be the first woman to run for the Senate from New York. And at that time, the Senate was entirely male. Mm. And she saw that as an outrage in itself. And New York was being represented by a Republican senator at the time. So Bella saw some movement, some space to potentially challenge the senator with, you know, a Democratic candidate. And, you know, the decision meant giving up her congressional seat, which was a huge risk, a huge gamble. A lot of people thought she shouldn't do it. She could have that congressional seat forever. But she didn't see things that way. She wasn't desiring to sort of get cushy into a seat. She wanted to challenge the Senate and to make waves there and to make more improvements in a bigger way. And I won't give away too much of the outcome, but that was a very in the streets of throughout the whole New York State,
yes,
battle for that seat. And just shows how bold and courageous she was that she could think of taking that on at such an early time.
Yes. You know, with all the indictments of our 45th president, some of us may not or may need a refresher course, let's say, in a 37th president of Watergate fame. But how did Nixon, but he wasn't alone, but Nixon and the CIA and the FBI, even the New York Times, tell us about that. What were they doing? What were they thinking?
Right. So Bella saw Nixon as just an enemy of the state from the beginning. Mm. She went to Congress to confront him and, you know, bring the voice of her constituents who were extremely unhappy about the war. Bella's background was in a group called Women Strike for Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, women who were not seen as walking in the streets with signs and protesting outside the White House were confronting that idea and bringing their voices to institutions like the White House, like the Senate. And she wanted to bring that voice directly into the Congress. She didn't want to be an outside agitator. She wanted to be an inside influencer. And she saw her election as a way to really confront Nixon. And the first time she met him, as she tells in the film, she basically told him, you need to end that war now. This was in a White House greeting line at an event that she was invited to. And, you know, as she tells it, it started everyone to sweat. And they sort of pushed her along, like, what's happening here? But, you know, that was the power that she saw was in her in reach and that she could actually make change. And in her third term, she was nominated to a committee that oversaw several organizations within the government, including the CIA and the FBI. And she confronted a lot of the activities they were doing, including programs that were spying on American citizens and collecting data, collecting large amounts of data on private citizens that she felt was wrong. And in doing so, she found out that the CIA was spying on her.
Mm-hmm.
Collected a huge, you know, folder on her activities dating back decades. So she was able to acquire those documents and sort of show as an example, like, any American can do this and request the information and make sure that their privacy rights were not being violated. So she really saw her role as one to protect citizens and also to protect the Constitution and the way the government was designed in the framers' minds, and that was being corrupted by a lot of cronyism and institutions that were sort of, you know, ignoring those facts.
Yes. You know, my next question is probably going to ask you to repeat yourself a bit. I apologize. But after 40 years, how did you gather the information you needed to make Bella? I mean, it's the award-winning film. It is. It's, you must have, as you mentioned, it's packed with history. Tell us about that.
That was quite the treasure hunt. And it's both exhilarating and frustrating. Exhilarating when you find something that you've been looking for, or you stumble across something you've never seen that you didn't know existed, but also frustrating because it's never enough. Mm. You're always looking for more, and you wish there was this, and you wish there was that. you know, prior to sometime in the late 70s, there were no real cameras on the house floor. So while it might not come to mind immediately when you're watching the film, there's really no footage of Bella speaking from the house floor, which is something she did regularly. And of course, that's frustrating. But there were a lot of archives that had a lot of great material. NBC, ABC, CBS were the primary sources because they were covering the news from Washington regularly. And they had mostly done a good job at preserving a lot of the stories that they did. And there were some private recordings. I spent about a week or two at Vanderbilt University, which has a great library and does a lot of recording of the nightly news for many decades. So mm-hmm. I was able to go through a lot of programs and see how the news was reporting on Bella. And then, you know, newspaper archives, magazines, speaking to photographers. Her papers are at Columbia University, so there was a good amount of information there. The Library of Congress had a lot of good information. There was a few libraries in Washington that have, like, the subcommittee papers. So I was able to see letters that people had written to Bella. Mm. That was really moving to see.
Yes. Wow.
Yeah.
What's next now? My Harlem, yes? And what's its focus?
Yeah. My Harlem is a screenplay I've written. And it's my first venture into narrative fiction filmmaking, which is something I've been wanting to do for a while. And as you said earlier, there's no easy way to pigeonhole me, which is intentional. And it's a story that I think is equally important, and like my documentary filmmaking, also has a lot of material to explore that's both meaningful and relevant and political, cultural. But it's basically a love story between two men in Harlem during a period where there was a lot of police violence, mainly against men of color. And it's sort of taking several characters and having them react to those events, and also the events of gentrification that was taking place in Harlem at that time and continues during this time. And so I really wanted to confront a number of issues with some real life people and sort of see how they responded to those events. But it's also actually basically a rom-com in a way, in its basic structure. It's not silly like a romantic comedy, but it's a love story. And I think for the LGBT film space, we get a lot of tragedies. We get a lot of like unhappy stories or death or disease stories. And I really wanted to make a film that showed a love story that was realistic, that sort of confronted, you know, what dating is like in these days, and to also kind of confront, you know, interracial dating. It sounds like it tackles a lot, but it's quite natural in that these characters are just real people trying to confront a world that surrounds them that's scary, but also just trying to find love too. And I hope to make that film next.
Fantastic. All right, I don't want to go away quite yet, because my question that I always ask every guest, but it's particularly important with you, what is it you want your audience to take away from your body of work?
A great question. I want people to be inspired. I want people to be enlightened. I want to entertain them. I want them to not feel like they're sitting down for history lessons, but to relax into a film or experience that's entertaining and enjoyable. I think with Bella, people are really going to see the humor and the charm. And there's a lot of really funny moments in this film. Bella was a character, and I think her humor comes across quite easily, and people will appreciate that she's so easy to get to know. And she doesn't let you off the hook with the humor. She challenges you in your beliefs and in your thinking and what you need to do to change the world. Same thing with Nina Simone. Like, she's there to entertain you with really enchanting music, but she's also there to challenge you in your beliefs and your your presence in the world. What are you doing to confront racism, for example? How are you bettering the world in the short time that we have? And yeah, I think all my films sort of speak to that. Like, what is it that you are going to do based on the example of these inspiring people who sacrificed on all our behalves?
Yes. Bella and Jeff Lieberman. Bella is written, directed, and produced by our guest today, Jeff Lieberman, and producer Jamila C. Fairley. And it will open theatrically in New York, as we said earlier, on Friday, August 18th, 2023, at the Village East by Angelica, and in Los Angeles on Friday, August 25th, 2023, at the Lemley. Jeff, this has been remarkable, and we need to let people know how they can reach you, any social media links you want to share so people can reach out and, hey, maybe there's somebody out there listening who wants to sponsor your next film.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. Yes, they can reach us at bella1970.com. That's the website for tickets for the screenings in both New York and L.A. You can also see the trailer for the film there. And that features a lot of amazing women as well that we should mention too. Barbara Streisand's in this film, and Hillary Clinton, and Lily Tomlin, and Shirley MacLaine, Nancy Pelosi, who was just at our previous screening in San Francisco this past weekend, which was a real thrill to have her there for one of the first screenings of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the whole body of work at reemergingfilms.com. And there's a hyphen in there. It's re-emergingfilms.com. And you can get in touch with me at both websites. And we're on Instagram and Facebook. All the links are through both websites. So, yes, please reach out. I'm happy to talk to anyone about all of these projects.
Fantastic, Jeff. It's been absolutely amazing and wonderful and uplifting and encouraging and enlightening and all the things film in particular, but all the arts do for us. They show us our foibles. They make us laugh at them, and then we go home and we think about it, and we get to be the chance, at least, to be better people. And you are doing your part, certainly, in all that you write and produce and direct. And wow, that's all I have to say. I'm so glad we met. I'm so glad you were on the show, and I look forward to our next conversations, plural. How's that?
That's great, and thank you for all the great questions. I really do appreciate shining a light on all of my work.
Well, thank you for all the great answers. All right, then. We've been talking with Jeff Lieberman, the producer, director, writer of Bella, and it's been a great pleasure. We thank you for joining us, and we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care, Jeff. Bye now.
Thanks again.
You got it. All the best.
Hi, I'm Jeff Lieberman, the director, writer, and producer of Bella, a new documentary film about the trailblazing Congresswoman Bella Abzug. In 1970, Bella, a lawyer and lifelong activist, decided she had had enough of supporting male political candidates who never fulfilled on their promises. She launched a campaign for Congress from the streets of New York, bringing together a coalition of women, LGBTQ people, diverse minorities, and people ready for change in Washington. With their support, she won and became one of just 12 women out of 435 House members in 1971. Throughout the 70s, Bella battled the male establishment, fighting for women to have credit cards in their own name, introduced the first gay rights bill, and began paving the way for more women to take on seats of leadership. Her story is a series of nail-biter campaigns, all while taking on Richard Nixon, the CIA, the FBI, and even the New York Times. Guiding us through Bella's story are brand new interviews with many of the women who were inspired by Bella's bold activism, including Barbara Streisand, Shirley MacLaine, Gloria Steinem, Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, Lily Tomlin, Maxine Waters, Marlo Thomas, and many more. The film opens on August 18th at New York's Village East Cinema and at Lemley Theaters in L.A. on August 24th. Tickets are now on sale at bella1970.com. Join us on opening night for talkbacks following the film.
Hi, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. The Crucifixion of America. All we like sheep have gone astray confesses our crucifixion from within. While neither global nor American first, domestic monsters seek to agitate the still tyrant voice within each of us. MAGA Republicans are increasing dissembling havoc, supporting a get-out-of-jail-free card for Trump Lifetime Criminal Achievement Award, using mesmerized minions, craving to be the welcome mat of a self-proclaimed shooter of someone on Fifth Avenue, while still guaranteeing his craven needs with malice aforethought to chisel American exceptionalism into his own image. While America has never been perfectly aligned with its legacy from what we put on parchment, proclaiming and claiming justice for all, since 6 January 2021, however, our House Divided has become a rallying cry for fundraising, mind-bending, and vote-getting and losing for one of our two major political parties. As the climate we've changed raises our weather temperatures, so too we're raising our anger, hate, gnashing of teeth, and clenched fists, allowing corporatism's wolves to claw out America's heartland and infiltrate the Bible Belt with their hoopla of la merde spread lavishly throughout all of America, doping up the desperately frustrated into national suicide. Thus have we stepped into the danger zone of too close to recall, both America's promised land of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and our planet's livable earth, water, and air, now also fired up to self-destruct. Still, he who claims he is the chosen one strides dangerously close to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, aided and abetted by superficially good people, Joe Manchin and RFK Jr., and bad people, Kevin McCarthy and Ron DeSantis, on both sides, reflecting each other's contest in Stupid Is as Stupid Does. Yet, only the right side decries by example that their very survival depends on America's failure to deliver on the promises of our Constitution's Bill of Rights, emancipating Gettysburg Address and, arguably, most importantly, our 14th Amendment. Further, arguably, since August 1945, when American political, military, industrial complex harbingers killed between 129,000 and 226,000 people, most of whom were civilians, and then in April 2004, monkey see, money do from black gold, our Bush-Cheney administration having invaded an Iraq innocent only of 9/11 attacks on America, illustrating Made in the USA resolve to use global campaign against terrorists impeding powerful American terrorists from gutting oil profits gluttony, the true raison d'etre for axes of evil, snake oil, repeatedly bombing Fallujah, causing, 1, countless Iraqi civilian deaths for profit, 2, increase in Al Jazeera's hate for all Americans, 3, reincarnation of the ugly American through American war criminals G.W. and Tricky Dick II, 4, in the name of we, the American people, the Guantanamo Bay detention facility still operating as a remnant of the war on terror euphemism. 5. America's branding as practitioners of waterboarding and, akin to World War II Axis powers, torturing prisoners of war. Too often, America's historical MO stigmatizes our current events, including the anti-wisdom choice to abandon, discard, and replace experienced Americans with the latest fad, device, or artificial intelligence bull hockey from spewing bankrolled mouthpieces. The ever-increasing weight of the reactionary conservative third of Americans is antithetical to our national evolution and individual progression, because, refusing any accountability for the rape we've allowed filthy rich politicians and their filthy rich corporate puppeteers to reap from our country and planet, transforms us into a momentarily mum McConnell and foul-fetid fuming former figurehead Führer, instead of paralleling Maya Angelou and Tom Hanks, for example. All those centuries younger than most of the world, America and Americans are old enough to remember a nation ignorant of its history is doomed to repeat the folly of placing individual faith in our youthful assumed invincibility. When defined by those calculating quality time in Instagram followers, Facebook likes, or worse, how the neighborhood has changed, it's wise to ponder through the art of comedy, tragedy of loss, even the melodrama of transversing the comings and goings of inevitable emotional tides, diminishing some relationships, until ultimately, through the tears and laughter of satire, we glean the wisdom of learning from farcical aging. Then, living ever forward, we may outrun Father Time for a pace. In this, our age of climate consequences, we need to expect to be called upon individually to emulate Irina Sendler, who was Warsaw's Schindler for infants and children. And remember James Waterman Wise Jr.'s warning: when fascism comes to America, it will not be identified with any shirt, movement, nor with an insignia, but it will probably be wrapped up in the American flag and heralded as a plea for liberty and preservation of the Constitution. Ah, an aha moment, perhaps? A big liar, racially similar to those historically vulnerable to big lies, infringing upon our commonality, perceived superiority, an American traitor, preying on our economic inequality, affirmative action jealousy, and cultural fears of being replaced by diversity. Our ballot, our choice. I'm Marcello Rolando, the reasonable voice, and I know where my voice belongs. I wish the same for you. Thank you, and join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.